for joining us. I'm Diane Rehm. The number of Americans owning a home has fallen to the lowest point in 20 years. A new study finds half of American homeowners would be better off renting and investing the savings in retirement accounts. Joining me to discuss the changing face of home ownership in America and why it might be better for millions to rent, Julia Gordon of the Center for American Progress, Michelle Singletary of the Washington Post, and Aaron Shapiro of Hello Wallet. I know many of you will have your own opinions to share. Give us a call at 800-433-8850. Send us an email to drshow@wamu.org. Follow us on Facebook or send us a tweet. And thank you all for being here.
Thanks so much for having us.
Good to see you.
Pleasure.
Julia Gordon, what's changing in the American dream? It used to be the first thing you wanted to do was buy a home. Changing?
Yes and no. I think what's important to remember is that home ownership is still the most proven way for families to acquire a stable place in a high opportunity neighborhood and over time to build savings and equity. That has not changed. What has changed is the labor market. What has changed is wages. And so many families now either feel like they can't afford a home or feel like they can't get together the down payment for a home, or they may be loath to commit to a home when they're still not sure about their long-term employment prospects. So for many, especially young people, renting is often a better choice. However, in my view, for longer term security of tenure and stability, and really ultimately the best wealth building opportunities, home ownership is still something that is a keystone of what we should be striving for.
And Aaron Shapiro, I know you recently completed a study of home ownership. You called it the House of Cards. Explain.
Sure. Well, buying is just not the only way to build wealth. A rent and invest strategy actually often outperforms buying. And we found that by looking at the last 30 years of data. And then we also look ahead, and we look at different kinds of plausible scenarios, and we find that in a lot of cases, people would be better off renting and investing, and they would be able to build more wealth that way.
How so?
Well, when you look at buying a home, you've got the mortgage payment, you've got the increase in property taxes, you've got maintenance costs, which I think people tend to underestimate. And I see you nodding along.
Yeah, I remember all that.
And then, of course, on the buying side, you're building a small amount of equity, at least for the first 10 years of home ownership. I mean, mostly when you buy a home, you're just renting from the bank. So if you get appreciation, you might do better than renting and investing. But in a lot of cases, you would actually do better, assuming you take that money and save it away.
And that's the kicker, isn't it? Assuming you take that money and put it away toward saving somehow.
Yeah, that's right. I work at a company that tries to give unbiased financial guidance to people. And when we were considering how do we think about home ownership, how do we give this advice, we wanted to be very clear that there are different strategies. Obviously, if you don't pursue the strategy of saving the extra money and putting it away, then it won't work. But I would note, we've got a huge savings challenge in this country overall. I mean, that goes for renters and it goes for buyers. We've got a deficit of savings, particularly for retirement accounts, that's, you know, probably in the billions, maybe the low trillions. And so we've got to find ways to get people to save, period. And some of these kinds of accounts can be pretty automated. You set it up with your employer, money's taken out, and if you never see it, hopefully you won't miss it.
And hopefully at some point you'll be able to take that and maybe buy a house, except if you have that kind of savings program with your employer, aren't you going to have to pay big taxes on it if you take it out?
I'm absolutely not saying that putting money in a 401k is a good strategy for saving up for a down payment.
Right.
That's a long-term wealth-building strategy in lieu of using homeownership as a long-term wealth-building strategy. If you're looking to save for a down payment, you certainly want it to be in safer and more accessible assets.
Do we have any idea how many people of any age are not buying homes now, but rather looking to rent, Aaron?
Well, there was a New York Times article a couple of weeks ago that pointed to an increase in millennials who are renting instead of buying. So I think that is happening. As you noted, home ownership rates have fallen from 70% to about 65%. You know, my sense of this is that basically we had a lot of policies that pushed home ownership harder than we traditionally pushed. We got a lot of marginal buyers into homes, people who probably would have rented in the absence of all of this encouragement. And now we're back to a more natural rate of home ownership.
Interesting.
So I think it's a mistake to look at rates of home ownership, because a lot of people like to talk about natural rates of home ownership, but actually the rates of home ownership are very, very different when you disaggregate who is the homeowner. Whites have extremely high rates, well over 70% of home ownership, whereas Blacks and Latinos lag far behind, which suggests to me that if we were to change our policies so as to make affordable home ownership an option for Blacks and Latinos, we actually could sustain a higher home ownership rate, which would be better for the macro economy. There's a lot about home ownership that also contributes to a healthy economy, to aggregate consumer demand, and to a family's feeling of stability. So I do think you will often hear people talk about some natural rate of home ownership. But when you start to break it down, you start to see it's not really so cut and dried and all that. And I just really want to underscore that it is absolutely theoretically correct that under certain assumptions, if you put money into certain types of accounts rather than putting in them into your house, at the end of the day, you might realize a higher return. But as you've noted, economic assumptions don't always line up with people's behavior. The forced savings nature of home ownership is something we've never really found a way to replicate anywhere else. People will do quite a lot to save their home, to make sure that they make the payment on their home. We've had a period of time that was very unusual with a lot of really predatory lending and then dramatic home declines due to the house of cards that Wall Street had been building. But generally speaking, especially lower income people will try very, very hard to pay their mortgage in a way, and I know this from my time doing some HR work for a small nonprofit, you will actually see that group of people be much more willing to suspend their 401k contributions.
I want to bring Michelle Singletary into the discussion. I know you are one who grew up with the idea of home ownership. Isn't that right?
That's right. I grew up with my grandmother, who raised me and my brothers and sisters, and I actually bought a home pretty early, even for someone in the new generation. I was about 21, right after college, about a year after college. I rented for a year, and my grandmother just yelled at me for a year about throwing my money away, and I had two choices. I could buy if I was ready, or move back in with her, and she was crazy. I mean, she's loving, but a little, getting me up at 6 a.m. when I didn't have to be to work till 10, and I did buy. But I have to say, I think when we talk about this, we have to understand that it's really not either or, renting or buying. The thing is, home ownership is right when it's right. And that's what we have to push, that you don't buy before you're ready, but when you're ready, buy.
And the idea that an awful lot of people, as you said, Aaron, were somehow convinced that they could buy because they were offered very low rates of interest. They were offered all kinds of conditions that sort of drew them into the housing market. really before they should.
And that's my sense of what's happened over the last, you know, 10, 15 years. I just want to come back to something Julia said earlier, if that's okay, about homeownership being a good device for forcing people to save.
Right.
You know, when you run the numbers, so I just looked at what interest rates are this morning. They're about 4%. So if I owned for 10 years at 4% with a traditional 30-year mortgage, 30% of my payment will be towards principal over those first 10 years.
Right.
70% will be interest. And so really, when you factor in the transfer cost, the closing cost for buying and selling, I'm relying to a very great degree on appreciation, much more so than any kind of, you know, forced savings from putting that money away.
And we know that appreciation is slowing somewhat.
I wish I could predict the future on appreciation, but I know, you know, the housing market crashes from time to time. And so if you're relying on that appreciation, that's a dangerous risk to be taking. The other thing is, Julia mentioned a couple of benefits, non-financial benefits of homeownership, that it makes, you know, communities stronger, that people can, you know, have the sense of place. But there are non-financial disadvantages in as much as you're trapped in a neighborhood.
And we'll talk more about those when we come back with Aaron Shapiro, Michelle Singletary, and Julia Gordon.
Support for NPR comes from NPR member stations and from Novo Nordisk, noting that 2/3 of people with diabetes live in cities. Novo Nordisk is committed to changing this statistic. Learn more at novonordisk-us.com. From the Pajamagram Company, offering matching holiday pajamas for the entire family, even the cats and dogs. Over 17 family sets online in knits, fleece, and flannel at pajamagram.com. And from the National Endowment for the Arts, art works.
And here is our first email from Sarah. She says, in Greenbelt, Maryland housing office on Saturday, I met a single mother with one high school son still at home, forced to move out of a two-bedroom apartment because rents are larger than the cost of buying a one-bedroom home in Greenbelt. Please discuss this. Julia, rents are going up.
In quite a lot of communities around the country, especially in large cities or around large cities like in Greenbelt, rents are quite high. There is a lot of demand for rental that's putting upward pressure on prices. And in many cases, if you have access to safe and affordable credit, you may end up with a monthly payment on a home that is less than what you pay for rent. Plus, as this person mentioned, you have that security of knowing that you're not going to get kicked out in the middle of the school year.
On the other hand, what she may not have figured in is the cost of upkeep of that house.
Absolutely critical that people understand the full cost of homeownership when they go in. I should be clear, while I am a proponent of homeownership, I am not a proponent of just home buyership and then losing your home later. You need to be financially prepared. I strongly advocate that anybody buying a house obtain some kind of financial or housing counseling before they do it, and make sure that you not only have a down payment, but that you have adequate emergency savings.
What's the average down payment these days on a regular 30-year mortgage through a bank?
Well, it depends whether you're getting an FHA loan or a conventional mortgage, but it's, you know, going to be somewhere between 10 or 15%. FHA mortgages, of course, you can get into them with a down payment of only 3.5%.
And if your credit's not good, you may be asked for a down payment of as much as 40%?
Absolutely. I mean, credit is very tight right now.
All right, and here's an email from Andrea, who says, I was allowed to buy a home with no down payment, faithfully paid every month for almost 8 years, along with HOA fees. What are they?
Homeowners Association.
Okay. I was forced to sell the home as a short sale, as I had to move across the country. Market prices plummeted. I feel nauseated when I think of the $500 per month over 8 years I could have put into retirement, not to mention the money I spent upgrading the place because everyone said it would help the resale value. All I ended up with is a blemished credit rating. Very disappointing.
Yeah, I think that's, you know, that's obviously a cautionary tale about buying and assuming it will definitely be the path to building wealth.
Here's another tweet from Jason, who says, having purchased a home in 2008 and watching my values drop, I failed to see how home ownership is a good wealth-building strategy.
So a lot of this really does depend on the housing market and also on the stock market. I will tell you, I am a homeowner, and during the Great Recession, my retirement fund actually plummeted far more than my home value did because I live in an area where home values didn't decline quite as much. So all of this is going to be a judgment call, which is why it's important to get professional advice. Most of us aren't qualified to predict either the housing market or the stock market. These things happen anywhere that you're putting your money. You are going to be at risk to some extent. With home ownership, you are just as with the stock market, your prospects are best over the long term. A mistake that we made during the housing bubble was people seeing homes as a short-term wealth-building exercise, you know, of the flip. I'm going to buy it for 2 years. It's going to appreciate by 100%, and then I'm going to make a lot of money. I do not advocate going into home ownership with that intention.
At the same time, we've just gotten an email from Nick, actually a tweet, who says, I just bought my first house after renting for most of my 20s, and not only am I saving money, I am significantly happier. And you too, Michelle, I'm sure, were very happy having bought your first house so early in life.
Yeah, you know, the fact of the matter is, my becoming a homeowner did change the legacy of my family. My grandmother was a homeowner, but my other siblings had difficulties, so they weren't initially. And so because I had a home, my disabled brother had a home. And so when I got married and moved to the Washington area to work for the Post, I was able to keep it was a condo, so that my disabled brother could live there. My husband and I paid the mortgage, which was very low, because at that time, you know, income increased, so we could afford to do that. And because of that, I was able to build up equity, and when I sold, I could take that and help other folks, you know, because my brother eventually passed away.
I'm sorry.
Thank you. I appreciate that. So it does change it, but, you know, what I don't want people to think is that what we're saying is that you shouldn't buy a home. That definitely, because we know the numbers show that most of people's net worth is built in their homes. But to the point of the study, what it's saying is that that's not the only way. And I think we have to change our language, because we tell renters that you are a financial failure if you rent. And I think that puts pressure on people to buy a home before they're ready.
Do you think that pressure is there?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I've experienced it personally.
And truly.
Just to be clear, and I completely agree with Michelle, I'm not against home ownership. What I'm for is giving people the tools to analyze this really complex decision and see if it's right for them. And I'll say, you know, this is sort of the American experience. I grew up, got married, and my parents said, why don't you buy a home? And without really, this was a couple of years ago, without really giving it any thought, we went and bought a home. And when I think about it now, you know, I wish I'd had the several months it took me to look through all the literature and the data, because I probably would have waited a little bit.
Tell me why.
For us, we're pretty good savers. We would have been able to save the extra money. And we're now pretty much stuck. I mean, we could move, but there are high transfer costs. We don't want to, you know, sell after 2.5 years. I took a new job, and my commute is much worse than it would be if I were a renter, because I would have just moved across the city. So it really wasn't the best choice for me. The irony of it is that I was the one saying we should really buy. My wife was saying, well, I don't know, maybe we should wait. And now she loves the place, so we're extra stuck.
And I can tell you from personal experience way back when, that the first thing my husband and I wanted to do was to buy a home. But on upkeep, I mean, right. Once we moved in, we could not afford to put a $50 storm window into my child's bedroom. We just didn't have the money. Right. So it's tight. Once you make that decision, you really have to take in lots.
Well, it's true. I think that it's, you know, for all of us, and I don't think you hear this group really disagreeing on the fundamentals here.
Yeah.
This is not some kind of binary choice that somehow you choose to buy and you're an owner for the rest of your life, or rent and you're a renter for the rest of your life. Most people cycle through different parts of being a homeowner and renter. Lower income people tend to actually make that move more frequently because of more volatility in their income. But I don't want to do policymaking by anecdote, but everybody is telling their story. My parents did not own a home, and I did grow up with the situation where sometimes it turned out you had to move and go rent the U-Haul and take a couple days off school to move the house. And it wasn't, I never really built a relationship with my home. My husband grew up in one home, and his mother lived there until it was, you know, finally time to sell after many, many years of being an empty nester. And I'll tell you, his childhood was pretty significantly different from mine.
I think one thing that I would encourage people is to listen to the right advice from the right folks. Quite frankly, and all deference to your parents, but we shouldn't be listening to folks who may not know what's going on with your own personal finances. Before you buy a home, I think you should be talking to a HUD-approved housing counseling agency or someone who doesn't have a stake in whether or not you buy a home. Don't listen to the bank. Your love parents. I'm a parent. I am definitely a helicopter shepherd parent. But when it comes time for my children, I want them to sit down with all the numbers. Now, I happen to be able to do that with my children because I do this for a living. But when I say don't listen to the bank, you cannot base your decision on people who have an interest in whether or not you buy. And quite frankly, the numbers that the banks use are not the numbers you should use to determine whether or not you buy a house. The ratios that they use are too high. They're based on your gross salary. Nobody brings home their gross salary unless you are a cheater and I'm going to turn you in. So you have to base your decision on your net numbers. What is your net income? And your housing should be no more than about a third of that, as most 36% of your net pay, not your gross. So when my husband and I bought our house, the bank said, oh, you can, af- afford this huge house. And I said, well, really? Because I'm taking care of a disabled brother. I'm contributing to my grandmother to make sure she's got some of the things she needs. We're saving for, you know, our retirement. And so my numbers show this is the house that we can afford. And we bought down from what they said we could afford.
That's really a good point.
I think those are great points. I'd add to that that most of the other advice that's out there is pretty heavily biased in favor of home ownership. You know, there are some online calculators. Right. They tend to overstate the tax benefits you'll get unless you're very wealthy. So that's another point I would add to that.
I agree with all of that, and I do want to point out that there are many misaligned incentives in the mortgage world, and you need to work with somebody who has your best interests at heart.
Now, wasn't there, perhaps I'm looking so far back, but wasn't there a recommendation that no more than 25% of your income go to home ownership? When did it rise to as much as a third?
So that has risen over time. Certainly that has changed over time. Some of it changes, you know, as incomes change. But I think the percentage isn't even that useful a guide, because you have to know how much money you need to live on. You need
right.
to know how much food, medical care, child care, transportation, and utilities cost, the actual numbers of how much they cost and how much you'll have left over after that mortgage payment. That's how you need to look at your budget, and that's the most effective way of making sure that people don't get in over their heads. I do want to say, though, that although it is incredibly important to get into an affordable home if you are going to home ownership. Again, back on the comparison of home ownership versus renting, it's true that in this country, the opportunities aren't exactly equal, because a lot of the better schools and neighborhoods won't have very many equivalent rental opportunities to home ownership opportunities.
And you're listening to the Diane Rehm Show. I want to talk about the tax advantages of buying a home. How valuable are they, Aaron?
They're very valuable if you're upper middle class, and they're not very valuable if you're middle class. And this takes a little bit of time to unwind, and, you know, taxes are complicated and not that easy to do over the radio. But basically, everybody gets the standard deduction if they want it, unless they want to itemize their mortgage interest deduction, which is the principal way that people get a tax benefit. So just in a nutshell, 92% of renters are taking the standard deduction. When they buy, they may or may not have more in itemizations than the standard deduction, but in either case, they have to account for that loss. Now, the standard deduction for a married couple is $12,400. So just to take a hypothetical example, if somebody buys, they work out their itemizations with their state income tax, their mortgage interest deduction, their property taxes, charity, comes out to $13,000. Well, they would have gotten $12,400, so their tax benefit is $600 times their marginal tax rate. We're talking about a whole $150 in tax benefits, and that's the first year. As the amortization schedule unwinds, there'll be less interest, the standard deduction will go up with inflation, and in fact, 75% of homeowners get no tax benefit, and 50% of mortgage holders get no tax benefit from homeownership. So, you know, these benefits are not widely distributed. However, they're always cited as reasons to buy, and that really kind of got under my skin. I wanted to point out that, you know, for most families in most cities, you're not going to get a big benefit. The benefit flows to rich families in high-cost areas, mostly on the coasts.
Michelle.
Yeah, and the other thing about that, and like you, it just burns me up when people say, oh, you know, the tax benefit.
Big
well, let's just really
benefit.
Look at that. If you're going to end up paying more in interest for the home than you would ever get back in a tax benefit, and I always try to people use it, let's just use a simple, it's really super simple, but say you pay $1 and homeowner and mortgage interest for a year, and you're in a 30-cent per tax bracket, so you're going to get 30 cents back. But if you don't have that dollar in interest for that mortgage, you got to pay 30 cents, but you get to keep 70 cents. I mean, do you see that you can't base your home ownership just on the tax benefit? First of all, you probably aren't going to take the interest deduction because you're not going to be itemizing, and you're still going to pay more in interest. So you got to look at all of these numbers and lay them out and make sure this all works for you before you plunge into homeownership.
And, Aaron, what about those popular online rent versus buy calculators? Are they misleading?
They are. They do two things that I think are really wrong. One of them is that they assume that you're already itemizing, and we know that for only 8% of renters that that's true. So for 90% of people, 90% plus, who would use these, they're overstating the tax benefit by quite a lot. So they're saying you're going to get 10% subsidy on your purchase, where you might get very little, maybe nothing. So that's a big problem. The other thing is that homes are a fairly risky asset. We all know that. They go up in value, they go down in value. And so it doesn't make any sense to do what these calculators do, which is to say the only alternative investment you could have would be to keep your money in the bank, paying, you know, your full marginal tax rate on your interest. I mean, that is not an equivalent alternative investment. You want to compare a fairly risky asset to another fairly risky asset. That's sort of a fundamental principle of financial economics. So they really aren't very good at helping you sort out the decision making.
Julia, I'm going to have to ask you to wait for your comment after a short break. We'll come back, take calls from our listeners. I'm really interested in what they have to say. Stay with us.
Support for NPR comes from NPR member stations and from the American Psychological Association, providing resources, tips, and other information for managing stress and emotional well-being this holiday season. Learn more at apa.org/helpcenter. From Rhodes Scholar, with educational travel adventures to 150 countries, including Cuba, at roadscholar.org. And from Joyce V. Hale, seeking a world challenged and invigorated through a deeper understanding of ideas.
On the next Fresh Air, British actor Timothy Spall. He won the Best Actor Prize at Cannes and a New York Film Critics Circle Award for his performance as painter J.M.W. Turner in the Mike Leigh film Mr. Turner. Spall also was in Leigh's films Topsy Turvy and Secrets and Lies and appeared in several Harry Potter films. Join us.
And welcome back. Time to open the phones, 800-433-8850. First to Dana in Toledo, Ohio. You're on the air.
Hi, Diane. Thanks for having me.
Sure.
You know, I just kind of wanted to piggyback on what everyone else was saying, but also I think especially for the lower and middle class people who make up a lot of the country here, owning a home is probably a very dangerous idea for all of the reasons that everybody already said, but also because a lot of people just assume that they're going to be keeping their jobs and that their income is always going to stay the same. But when you have all these foreclosures and all these things, it's 9 times out of 10, it's because they're living outside of their means, or it's my husband lost his job, I got laid off, something like that. So I would much rather live, you know, in the rest of my 20s and 30s renting. And that way, if things go south, I can just take a job, you know, either overseas or in another area or even across the country without having to have the burden of a house.
That is a perspective.
It's definitely a good perspective, and I understand what she's saying. I would just quibble a little bit. I wouldn't say homeownership is very dangerous. I think that's a little too strong, but I hear what you're saying. And so if you work the numbers, even when you're lower income and lower middle class, homeownership still makes sense if you work the numbers and you have a cushion. See, to me, that's the way how you protect against job loss and the things in life that happen. So when I'm talking to people about homeownership, I ask them to have an emergency fund, 3 to 6 months living expenses. I also ask them to have what I call a life happens fund so that you don't rob the emergency fund. So if your car breaks down, so if you've got a clunker of a car, you want to have some money separate from your emergency fund. And then all the money would take to buy a house. So that way, if there is a job loss, there is a period where you have a cushion. And that makes homeownership less dangerous.
Well, this is really fascinating because we can see the impact that the foreclosure crisis had on the way people view their homes. The foreclosure crisis was caused by a lot of people being put in toxic and inappropriate mortgage products, most of which are actually illegal now. And my fervent hope is that because we have tightened up the mortgage rules so much, going forward, I hope that we never see any kind of foreclosure crisis like what we saw. But the fact is, when you look at things like the American Community Survey, moving far away for a job is actually much less common than we might imagine it in our mind. The vast majority of people move less than 50 miles. Most stay inside the county that they're in. And, you know, of the last American Community Survey, of the about 11% of people who moved, actually, 50% of them moved for housing-related reasons, likely because they had to out of a rental or they had a foreclosure than for their job.
Here's an interesting email that sort of follows up on your points, Michelle. 2 years ago, my wife and I were looking at condos to buy in our Chicago neighborhood. Nick says, but we decided to wait, and boy, are we glad we did. My wife's career took an unexpected hit. She was laid off. Our down payment savings allowed us to weather the loss in income, and it allowed her to start a company of her own in our apartment, all without turning to a bank or our families for help.
Yeah, that's exactly how you do it. You try to build a cushion, and you can build that cushion a lot quicker than you think if you make certain decisions. And I tell, for example, 20-year-olds, lots of young folks have student loan debt right now. The average is 30%, but, you know, that's what the average means. Some have more, some have less. And if I say if you have student loan debt, go back and live with your parents, live with someone for, like, nothing, rent a room, and take those early earning years to pay off that debt so that when you are preparing yourself for homeownership, because I'm still a huge advocate for homeownership, it stabilizes neighborhoods, it stabilizes families, but it doesn't stabilize it if you do it before you're ready. It can actually destabilize yourself and your immediate family, because then other family members try to help bail you out, and that takes their cushion away. And so I love when I hear stories like that, because what they did was they worked the numbers.
Exactly.
And that is the key takeaway. If you don't listen to anything else we say, you don't remember anything. Just work the numbers.
Highland, Indiana. Hi, Bill. You're on the air.
Thanks, Diane. Great show. One point I wanted to raise is my wife and I were renters for a period of about 7 years. And one of the things we had to deal with was a 5% increase in rent every single year. So over time, our rent went from an affordable $850 to about $1,200 for the next year after we moved. What I did was went with a local mortgage lender, which is one of those things I would highly suggest. And we reverse engineered the numbers from a standpoint of, this is what I can afford per month for rent, how much house can I afford, and then got pre-approved. Not just pre-qualified, but pre-approved. So I knew, like your guest is saying, I knew the numbers. The numbers were affordable. And again, unless you have rent control, that's one of those very real things to deal with, is that increase in rent. Whereas once we bought, we locked in that price for the next 30 years.
Absolutely.
Absolutely. And one of the most important things about getting a long-term fixed-rate mortgage is the ability to lock in and know exactly what you will be paying for shelter over time and not being up to the whim of the landlord. Not only do we not have rent control in, you know, left in this country in any meaningful way, but in most policy rooms, I'll tell you, even mentioning it can get you left out of the room. So I think it is very important for families looking for financial stability. Again, if you're in the position we've talked about, if you have a savings cushion to deal with unexpected eventualities, if you have the income, if you can afford it, if you can find a sustainable loan that you know you can pay over the long term, that makes sense.
What about condo purchasing? People don't quite always figure in that there is an additional monthly fee for owning a condo, Michelle.
Yeah, there's the condo fee, but there's also something that they don't expect. If the condo association decides that they need to do up improvements, that can really wreck your budget. I mean, depending on how old the complex is, for some people, it could be several thousand dollars. And the other thing about buying a condo, I mean, I had a condo, and I'll be quite honest, this is all anecdotal. I wouldn't do it again. Because, you know, you've got so many unpredictables. For example, if it more than a certain percentage are renters in that complex, it makes it difficult for you to sell because a certain percentage has to be buyers. And so that increases your cost and you can't get rid of the condo. I had a friend who just went through that. It was too many renters. And so the person she was trying to sell to was having trouble getting a mortgage. Yeah. So for some people, condos are great. In some big cities, that's all you can get. That's fine. But again, just know what you're getting into, that there's all these additional costs that you have to put into your budget to anticipate down the road.
Well, I think one thing that we haven't touched on, I agree with all of that, actually. And one thing with condos, it's sort of the easiest thing where the easiest home purchase where you can compare rent to it, right? Because, you know, most rental properties are apartments, so you can kind of get a sense of what the value of the condo is. And I think that that's something we haven't talked about. People need to really focus on the rent that they would be paying instead of buying, because that's going to tell you the underlying value of what you're purchasing. And in some parts of the country right now, you know, that number is very low. You could rent for a very low percentage of the purchase price, and that's telling you that things are kind of overvalued. And when the rent is very high compared to the purchase price, it's telling you that things are undervalued and you should probably buy. And you know, condos, it's actually easier to do that calculation than single family homes, but there are big risks with condos because you don't know what the underlying state of the HOA is.
All right. Let's go to Lucy in Arlington, Virginia. Hi, you're on the air.
Hi, Diane. First-time caller, long-time listener.
Glad
thank you
to
for taking
you.
My call.
Surely.
Thank you. I have been eager to call in since I heard you promoting the show. I am in a very different situation from my friends and the socioeconomic circles that my husband and I travel in. We rent, and we're longtime renters, and we've rented as we raised our child, who's now in college. And there are particular reasons to do it. There was flexibility. We were able to move when we wanted to put our daughter into a different school. But overall, and your guests have touched on this briefly, is the incredible instability. We would interview homeowners, and we would ask them about the long-term prospect, and they promised us up or down, up and down. One house went into foreclosure. Another house, the owner died. Another house, you simply wanted to fix it up and rent it out again, so we had to move. And it happened over and over and over. It's very embarrassing. You know, most people, when they move, they're congratulated, you have a new home. And for us, it was always because the owner changed his or her mind. Now, you have some callers who talked about the rent increases. What happens after a while is it gets hard to save for that down payment because rents are higher. We have at times gotten fabulous rents, and then because we've had to move, the cost of moving, the disruption to our child during the school year. So overall, it really has not been a good idea for us at all.
Thanks for the call. I think that is really one of the best reasons to buy, to lock in that stability. I definitely think that is a very compelling argument for ownership.
The other problem, once again, is how many people have the financial discipline and the financial wherewithal to put aside a certain amount of money each and every month that they promise themselves they will not touch.
It's very difficult. It's extremely difficult. I direct a ministry at my church that I started called Prosperity Partners, and it's a 10-month program in which, you know, we match up folks who are good with their money with people who have financial challenges, and we start a new program in January, a new group of people, 200 and some people.
Good for you.
You know, about halfway through, half of them drop out because they don't want to do the work. They don't want to listen to, you know, why this program works, why we encourage you to save, why we tell you to get out of debt. And quite frankly, life happens. They get divorced. Their kids get sick. They lose their job. They change jobs. And then there's a period where their pay hasn't started. And so to develop this discipline, you need help. And I would encourage all homeowners, not just homeowners, but renters and stuff, get into a program, take a class, go
That's
to something that will encourage you. Get an accountability partner, to help you stick to this. You know, I have three kids. I totally get it. I wonder during those years where they had low rent, did they save? And probably not. Things happen, kids in sports programs and things like that. But this is why you have to do it and why you need programs like we have at my church and other things to help put something in place so that you can.
I think the idea of your program is really one that could be spread around. It's a terrific idea. And you're listening to the Diane Rehm Show. Let's finally go to, Bill in St. Louis, Missouri. Hi, you're on the air.
Hi, Diane. I'm calling because I want to make the point you don't want to overestimate the wealth portion of owning a house, because if you decide to move, you are going to have to buy a house. You always have to have a roof over your head. And the obviously only the increase in value would be profit. Because you own a certain house that's worth $600,000 does not mean your wealth should be estimated at $600,000.
That's right. He's absolutely right. He's absolutely right. I love that point. And we all found that out. When I do speaking engagements, I ask everybody, especially in this area, if you're a homeowner. And usually 50 to 60 people raise their hand. And then I ask the question again, how many of you are homeowners? And then they're sort of like, what does she mean? And then finally it dawns on them. Most of them are not homeowners because they don't actually own their home. They have a bank note. They don't own their home. And that's the
key. Takes a while.
It takes a while.
Is there, as our earlier caller from Arlington suggested, something of a stigma attached to renting that persists despite the fact that younger and more people are renting? She is a serial renter for reasons she stated.
I think it really depends on what community you're in and what age you are. Certainly for younger people, I don't see that much of a stigma to rental. And in fact, in this area, you all often have to convince young people to even think about it, especially young single people. People are getting married later. They're having children later. And all of that is impacting when people are ready to think about home ownership. Something I think we can do is think about whether there are middle grounds between home ownership and rental, such as shared equity or shared appreciation programs, where homeowners take less of that downside risk and are really in the home as a place to live as opposed to try to make it as a big investment.
I want to ask you quickly about reverse mortgages, because so many people, older people, are getting into these. Michelle, What are your thoughts on that?
You know, I'm not a debt person, and reverse mortgages scare me for a lot of folks. They do work for some people.
Who are going to stay in that home for a long time.
Exactly. If you're going to stay put in that home and you're fairly healthy and you don't think that you're going to have to move and you have no money, I mean, you've got very little money, but you need let me actually reverse that. You've got some income, but you need to supplement some of that income. Say you've got enough, but you've got having trouble maybe buying your medications and things like that. You need an influx of cash, because the thing about reverse mortgages is there's no note. You don't pay unless you have to move, or you sell, or if you become sick and you have to move. So that's the appeal of it. So you don't have a monthly payment. It is not appropriate if that's all the money you're going to have and you're going to run through it. So then you're going to not have any money for the long term. It is absolutely not. That means that you need to look at some things, and perhaps you need to move in with someone, bring in a renter or something to that extent. So say you borrowed $200,000. If you're going to go through that in 5 years or so, then that mortgage is not appropriate you, because the costs are high. The costs have come down, but they're not as high as they used to be. But you have to, again, run the numbers. And definitely, well, it's required that you have to go through HUD counseling. But not just that, but understand that if you're really, is this is all the money that you're going to be using from that, it's not appropriate for you.
So you got to be careful.
Right.
There are so many advertisements on television, right. Former Senator Fred Thompson being one. And, you know, it worries me because people trust certain people. And when you see a former senator on television promoting this, you might think, oh, well, he knows, and I'll do that. Just be careful. And as all of our guests have said, run the numbers. Michelle Singletary, Julia Gordon, Aaron Shapiro, thank you all.
You're welcome.
Thanks so much
for
having us.
And thanks for listening, all. I'm Diane Rehm.
The Diane Rehm Show is produced by Sandra Pinkert, Denise Couture, Susan Casey, Rebecca Kaufman, Lisa Dunn, Danielle Knight, Allison Brody, and Alexandra Boti. The engineer is Timothy Olmsted.